It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
I want to say a few brief words about the passing of Joan Lieberman at 82, complications from a fall, because I knew the senator pretty well. And back in the 90s, he was on something of a crusade against the violence and the culture of violent rap lyrics and things of that nature. And I remember he had a forum and he invited me to be one of the speakers. And this was something that was sort of a labor of love for him. He was a centrist Democrat. He was certainly, everybody who came into contact with him found him to be very gracious and gentlemanly. He was hawkish on foreign policy. In fact, he, John McCain, and Lindsey Graham were sort of the three amigos. They would travel around the world to trouble spots. And, you know, when he became really well known is when Al Gore picked him as his running mate in 2000, and it had not been for, you know, what was it, 537 hanging chads in Florida, he would have been the first Jewish vice president. As it was, he was the first Jewish politician to run on a major party ticket. And then, just 8 years later, because of his relationship with McCain, Lieberman spoke at the Republican convention on McCain's behalf, despite the fact that he was a Democrat. He took a whole lot of heat from his party on that. And I think it said something about the way he had evolved. He then lost the Democratic primary while running for re-election in Connecticut, but ran as an independent and won. So he ended up serving one additional term. And, you know, he's almost like a throwback to a time when there was bipartisan cooperation and people cared more about issues than vilifying the other side, which kind of leads me into the first item here, which is story number one. So tonight, and this is going to get a lot of media hype, no doubt, Joe Biden will be in New York with Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. So the current Democratic president, the last two Democratic presidents, big fundraising event, expected to raise a whole lot of money. The penetrating journalist Stephen Colbert will be questioning all three presidents. I'm sure that will be tough. And fine, you know, why wouldn't Biden want to associate himself with those guys? But interesting piece or twist in the New York Times, essentially trying to explain away why of the three politicians, Biden is the least popular. You know, obviously some of this has to do with when you're in office and you're taking all the slings and arrows and the problems are mounting every day. It's different than when you're a former president. And we've seen this to some extent with Donald Trump as well. When memories of the bad things fade and memories of the accomplishments still shine through, maybe even some nostalgia. But the way the Times puts it is of the triumvirate of recent Democrats in the White House, Biden is the one who historians, political strategists, and policy experts argue has racked up the most expansive list of legislative accomplishments and has received the least amount of credit for them. So in other words, Joe Biden, you know, kicks butt when compared to the man who picked him to be VP, Obama, and compared to Bill Clinton. Got a lot of stuff done, but, you know, I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say he's just not as good a politician, or at least the part of the political game, the skill set, where inspiring the country, giving great speeches. I mean, you know, you're picking Clinton and Obama, you're talking about two of the great communicators of the Democratic Party. You know, whether you disagree with everything they stood for, they both knew how to give a speech. Biden gave a pretty good State of the Union last time, but, you know, he would be the first to admit that he's not a stirring orator. So there's a little review of, look, Biden got $2 trillion in pandemic funding, $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure spending bill, $370 billion to fight climate change, modest gun control measures, and yet his approval ratings are the lowest of all three. And voters are far more pessimistic about the future. They're not confident in his ability to serve a second term. Well, look, neither Obama nor Clinton ran for re-election at 81. Although there were times in the third and even early fourth year of each man's presidency where it was not considered to be a lock that they would be reelected. It certainly was true of Obama. It was more true of Clinton once Bob Dole was his opponent, because Bob Dole was considered old and, of course, had war injuries. But I don't have it at my fingertips how old Bob Dole was, but he certainly was not over 80. So here's a quote from Leon Panetta, who was Bill Clinton's chief of staff, who was also a cabinet official for Obama, saying Biden's biggest problem is not so much his ability to get things done, as we've seen, but his ability to put together a message that reaches the average American, no matter where they're located, red state or blue state, to get them to understand what he's trying to do for the country. You know, I mean, I've been saying since basically the day that Biden was sworn in that although he ran as the sort of antidote to Trump, although he wanted a return to a sort of lower key, more normal presidency than one that was surrounded by controversy and chaos, you know, he just would disappear and not make a lot of news for long stretches. You know, I've talked before about, you know, his limited engagement with the press, putting out statements instead of going before the cameras. And the Times piece tries to let Biden off the hook by saying, well, these, it's a different era. So another person quoted is Rahm Emanuel, who I got to know when he worked for Bill Clinton. I was working on a book about the Clinton White House. And then he became Obama's chief of staff. And then he became mayor of Chicago. And he is now Biden's ambassador to Japan. He said, presidents and even American governments have never recovered the trust they had before two seminal events, the Iraq War and the 2008 financial crisis, both of which occurred during the Bush administration. No public official was ever prosecuted for their involvement in either one. Remember, like, all these bankers, all these people lost money, all these banks collapsed, and nobody was sent to jail. Now, the Iraq War is sort of different, and certainly the Bush administration was held politically accountable, although George W. Bush managed to get himself reelected at a time when the war in Iraq was not quite as terribly unpopular as it came to be seen in his second term. So Rahm says the pre-Iraq War, pre-financial meltdown is one era, and then Obama and Biden operate in another era. In fact, at the time when Rahm was working for Barack, he pushed the president to deal with financial reform in the wake of that crisis. Remember, Obama was running against McCain, and they even sort of suspended their campaigns for a couple days and had a meeting. You know, how were they going to, you know, you had Bush as a lame duck, the country in dire financial straits, the financial crisis and the Wall Street crisis exploding. And so Rahm said, deal with the financial crisis before you take on something such as complicated as healthcare. But Obama decided to do Obamacare. Those two moments trigger a period of anger where the entire establishment earns the public's resentment and distrust. Remember, both parties had a hand in the financial crisis. And the media, I talked and wrote about this extensively at the time. missed a lot of warning signs, with a few exceptions in the trade press, didn't see it coming. All those subprime mortgages were being handed out to people who, you know, were not going to be able to carry the mortgages, not being able to pay them, particularly if the economy took a downturn, which is what happened. After that, says Emanuel, you can't give me any politics or politicians at the national level that really get credit.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
Story number two. Wow. Wow is part of this quote. I may have mentioned this yesterday, but with the whole uproar that I have talked about and covered extensively about NBC, MSNBC, and Ronald McDaniel, who lasted 4 days, that's not even a half a Scaramucci, and for the $600,000 that she was supposed to be paid over 2 years, NBC got one 20-minute interview on Meet the Press. Somebody calculated, I don't know, it was $30,000 a minute or something. And she's lawyering up, and there will be a lot of that. But anyway, Trump says, wow, Ronald McDaniel got fired by fake news NBC. She only lasted 2 days. Yeah, I did talk about this meeting after the Meet the Press. And she went out of her way to say what they wanted to hear. It leaves her in a very strange place. It's called Never Never Land. Not a place you want to be. These radical left lunatics are crazy. The top people are NBC are weak. They are broken. They were broken and embarrassed by low ratings, highly overpaid, quote, talent. But another interesting development involving the former president is this. The merger involving his social networking site, Truth Social. And it went public on NASDAQ just yesterday. And as often happens with these new IPOs, the stock surge. What happens is only the insiders get to buy it early on, often at a more competitive price. And then everybody else tries to get in because they see that it's hot. By then, you know, they may get some of the gains, but it's sort of too late for the average investor. So, 2 days, actually, so NASDAQ was Tuesday and Wednesday, of trading. And the parent company, Truth Social, is now valued at about $9 billion. A windfall for insiders awarded shares in the company. And that includes Devin Nunes, the former congressman. I mean, these people are making millions. The biggest beneficiary, wait for it, Trump. His stake is worth more than $5 billion, at least on paper. And right now, needless to say, he can use the money. No other shareholder comes close. And now we get to the part where, well, Trump and other major shareholders and what's called Trump Media are barred under the terms of the stock from selling their shares for at least 6 months or even using them as collateral. However, I don't think if Trump wants to cash in now, at least some of it, he's going to have trouble getting permission from the board to waive or change that rule, since it's all a bunch of loyalists he appointed, including his son, Don Jr. Trump also getting in on the RFK running mate business. You'll recall that the son of Bobby Kennedy, who's now running as an independent, had this big event to introduce his running mate, a woman named Nicole Shanahan, who's never run for office. Nobody's ever heard of her, but she is fabulously wealthy. In fact, she said at this event that, you know, she got her wealth late in life, and so she has always believed in sort of the principles of the Democratic Party, which is, you know, use power and use money to help those in need. Except now she's had to declare herself to be an independent in order to work with former Democrat RFK Jr. So Trump says that Nicole Shanahan, this is again on his now valuable Truth Social site, is even more radical left. Well, he says Kennedy is even more radical left than Biden and supporting the Green New Deal and so forth. But then Trump says, I love that he is running. And you don't have to dig very deep to know why Trump would say that. It's because he is widely seen as taking more votes from Biden than from Trump. Why? Because, how shall I put this? I mean, even leaving aside the very legitimate controversies about his views on vaccines and other health issues, you know, Kennedy is, on a lot of key issues, a liberal. And so if you voted for Joe Biden last time, but now you think he's too old, or you have reservations about a second term, or you think Biden has moved too far left, Kennedy now is there. We'll see how many state ballots he gets on, and that's why he needs Nicole Shanahan's millions, as a kind of a available protest vote. You know, you can't bring yourself to vote for Trump, but you don't, you just have lost confidence in Biden, or you think his time has passed. So you vote for Kennedy, and you tell yourself you're doing the right thing. Now, there are polls showing he takes from both candidates equally, but I'm just not buying that. But just to show you how RFK kind of bounces around, and of course, most of his family is against his running, and this was especially true when he was running as a Democrat against President Biden. Kennedy last year came out for a federal ban on abortion, but that is not going to fly with left-leaning voters, so he backtracked. Now says he supported a woman's right to choose. I mean, if he was being taken more seriously by the press, this would be seen as a tremendous flip-flop, and, you know, he'd be pounded every day. But, you know, he doesn't get that much coverage. He's more of a novelty candidate at this point. But that, you know, it's one thing to sort of change your view on the capital gains tax. It's another to say abortion should be banned. But, oh, no, actually, we should support a woman's right to choose. He also opposes military aid to Ukraine, putting him at odds with many mainstream Democrats. All right, story three. This is a local story, but nonetheless, a fascinating one. New York City, and this has been going on for decades, I've heard this talked about. I never thought it would actually happen. And it hasn't quite happened. But basically, New York City is ready to launch a congestion pricing program. What that means is, if you want to drive your car into Midtown Manhattan or Lower Manhattan, you have to pay for that privilege. So this could get underway by June. With the whole idea is to free up money for mass transit, with the Metropolitan Transit Authority voting 11-1 to approve the final rates. If you want to drive, I mean, this is obviously impacts people in the whole tri-state region, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, particularly suburbanites or just people who live in the outer boroughs. I mean, that's the thing is, you know, most people think of New York, they think of the city, they think of Manhattan. But the bulk of the population lives in Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, and Staten Island. Costs you $15 a day to drive into Manhattan at 60th Street or below. This is expected to raise about $1 billion for improving mass transit. And other cities around the world have shown that you can cut traffic and pollution. This includes London, Stockholm, and Singapore. But if there's a major city in the U.S. that charges, this kind of fee. I'm not aware of it. This is expected to reduce the number of vehicles that enter Lower Manhattan by 17%. And look, if you've ever tried to drive in Manhattan, I mean, it can take a very long time just to go across town, just to go from First Avenue to 10th Avenue. It's just often gridlock. Getting over the bridges and tunnels can be gridlock. So basically, they're trying to drive people out of their cars by making it expensive. Now, obviously, for a lot of people, they can afford it, or it's part of the cost of doing business, or their companies will pay it or whatever. But for less well-off commuters, you know, who aren't just going into Manhattan to see a play, but have worked there, and maybe now are afraid of the subways. I mean, subway service in New York, you know, they're, as the equipment has aged, you know, it's like a more than a 100-year-old system. Biggest by far in the country. I think it's 472 stations. But now there's been a surge in crime and homeless people panhandling. And, you know, it's not that these problems didn't exist before. They have gotten so much worse. And, you know, there's been violence, which is why they're trying to put more cops in the stations and on the trains, with people being pushed onto the tracks. It's just a horrible situation. Andrew Cuomo played a big role in pushing this. But part of the deal is, if you make less than $50,000 a year, you can apply through the state bureaucracy to get half off the daytime toll after your first 10 trips. That's a little complicated. And if you live in the congestion zone and you make less than $60,000, you can apply for a state tax credit. So at least there's some effort to not unfairly sock people who have to, either because of where they live or where they work, you know, drive into Midtown or drive into Wall Street or Lower Manhattan. And I think this is going to be held up by lawsuits. If I had to guess, everything is held up by lawsuits in New York. I mean, it took like a zillion years to get the Second Avenue subway. But it's an interesting urban experiment, I guess is what I would say. If this works, if it reduces traffic, so it means the people who do drive can at least get around a little easier, and if it pours a lot of money into mass transit and cuts pollution, it'll be a success. If not, I'll come back and talk about it.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Story number four, a couple of sports items for you. I feel like the... Now let's get a check of the sports and weather with Billy Bob. All right, so it made big headlines, certainly in this area, but really nationally as well, when the Washington Wizards NBA team and the Washington Capitals hockey team were going to move to Virginia. It wasn't that long ago that this really nice downtown stadium was built for those two teams, and they have other events there as well, revitalizing a part of downtown D.C. But now, Mayor Muriel Bowser and the guy who owns the two teams, Ted Leonsis, said yesterday they're finalizing a deal that will keep the teams downtown until 2050. D.C. would have to kick in $515 million over 3 years to modernize the arena. Now, you might say, well, that's pretty good work on behalf of D.C. officials, except the only reason this is happening is because the Virginia deal blew up. I mean, they went out across the Potomac, and they had big news conferences just 3 months ago with Governor Glenn Youngkin. And they were going to redevelop this area of Alexandria, $2 billion development. But the state Senate wouldn't pass it, and it wasn't in the state's budget. So Youngkin couldn't get it done. So the mayor of D.C., having almost had the team snatched out from under her, now gets to come in and say, oh, yeah, that's all right. We still want you. We still love you. The other sports item. And you've heard me talk on several occasions about this college basketball phenomenon, Caitlin Clark of Iowa, who whose team is heading into one of the tournaments. Unbelievably good shooter, three-point shooter. Now the highest scoring player, male or female, in the history of college basketball. Well, Ice Cube, the rapper, I did not know this, has a basketball league of his own called the Big Three, which involves three-on-three play as opposed to full court. This is what I grew up playing in Brooklyn because there weren't often many full courts available. So you played a half-court game, different set of skills, three players on each side. And then if you lost, you had to sit down and wait your turn again. So it could be pretty competitive there in the asphalt jungle. Ice Cube and his league have offered Caitlin Clark $5 million. But wait, it gets better. $5 million, and all she has to do, as first reported by TMZ, is play 10 games. She'd get even more than that from endorsements and merchandising. Now, if she just goes into the WNBA, which is the normal route, the salaries there don't really rise much above $300,000. And Ice Cube set it up so that she'd still be able to play in the WNBA. He sees his Big Three league as an alternative to what WNBA players do during the offseason, which is go and play in foreign countries, which we all know after the captivity of Brittany Griner in Russia. Ice Cube says on X, America's women athletes should not be forced to spend their offseasons playing in often dismal and dubious foreign countries just to make ends meet. They should have more than one professional option in the U.S. At a time when American pro sports leagues, this is interesting, are being infiltrated by autocratic anti-women regimes such as Qatar. Caitlin Clark hasn't said anything about this. She's concentrating on the Sweet 16. Next game is Saturday. And who knows? But, I mean, imagine that you were her and had her skills. Would you turn down $5 million to play in a measly 10 games? And the New York Times sports unit, The Athletic, had this story about Caitlin Clark's shooting, having a couple of sort of engineers analyzing it and saying how she has sort of the perfect shot. She not only has the quick release, but she's 6 feet tall. She releases it the ball at a very high point. The arc, the trajectory on her three-point shots is just, you know, what you would design in a lab. Perfect thing to drop into the basket. And the paragraph that stuck with me is that on days when she has a game, or maybe it's on off days, she goes to practice. In every practice session, she takes 300 shots from different distances. So she'll take more short-range jumpers and try to hit 80% of them. She'll take longer-range three-point jumpers and try to hit 70% of them. She just has these goals. 300 shots. I'm sorry. If I took 300 shots in practice, they would carry me off the court. But that just shows her determination and the fact that you don't become Caitlin Clark without working at your sport, your craft, very, very hard. All right, number five. Remember when Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and Instagram fame launched his Twitter copycat known as Threads? And I don't know, it was like 4 or 5 days, it had like a million users. People who were on Instagram could automatically sign up. So it's been around for a while now. And Pamela Paul, in her New York Times column, says that the more people that join Threads, which was pretty bare bones at the beginning, and it's still actually pretty bare bones compared to Twitter, there was a sort of enthusiasm that caught on, like watching a schoolyard of kids unleashed from detention. AOC was very excited about it. May this platform have good vibes. So now it's been 10 months. And this is what Threads has become, in her opinion. in the author's opinion. A full-on bizarro world X, handcrafted for the left end of the political spectrum, complete with what one user astutely labeled a cult-type vibe. If progressives and liberals were provoked by Trumpers and Breitbart types on Twitter, on Threads they have the opportunity to be wounded by their own kind. The algorithm seems tweaked to confront the user with posts devoted to whichever progressive position is slightly lefter than thou. So it has become a kind of a refuge for people who think Elon Musk has turned X into a right-wing haven. I don't totally buy that. I do think a lot of people have left because they either don't like Musk or they don't like what Twitter has become. But people were bitching and moaning about Twitter and some were quitting, you know, a couple years ago and long before Musk bought it. So this has become a sort of a liberal and center-left operation on Threads. It knows where you stand with regard to the Middle East, gender ideology, DEI, body positivity, COVID, and creative industries, and shows you posts screaming from whichever position is just far enough from yours to drive you out of your mind. Oh, that sounds like fun. In this microverse, arguments you probably didn't even know existed. Every time I see a white person in a kafiyeh, I wonder, how much have you studied the issue? Devolve into accusations around tokenism, solidarity, and identity. There's something guaranteed to offend anyone who wants to get offended, or your money back. Well, it doesn't actually cost anything. Confessions of emotional upheaval and mental health crises operate like a kind of currency. One user says, Threads is a great example of how the left gets its own way by parsing absolutely everything and anything anyone says or writes that is mildly positive or not negative enough or blah, blah, blah. I'm sure a lot of thought went into that post. Now, Pamela Paul says her phone's Face ID still won't recognize her face, but Threads managed to gain access to the deep recesses of her amygdala. Some line reader. Rather than display the cat content I seek, its landing page defaulted to an algorithmic for you. You have a choice, actually, for you or not for you, or is that Twitter? Anyway, what Threads thought was for me was a tailor-made stream of trigger bait. I'd log on and be faced with ludicrous Princess Catherine trutherism, painstaking purity tests to weed out the merely progressive from the resolutely anti-capitalist and furious debates over who is the most anti-Zionist in precisely the correct way. It wasn't just me. One user says, Thread seems to be purposely pushing content that opposes your personal beliefs and values, thus getting everyone triggered. They intentionally show you stuff you dislike. Okay, if you get off on that kind of thing. Novelist Daniel Torday said, this space has become almost as unusual as Twitter was. I'm out. But what's interesting here is two things. One is, if friction and arguments, you know, which we all lamented about Twitter, and Facebook has also become more politically polarized, which is why Facebook and Instagram are trying to move away from politics into other kinds of engagement. If that becomes the sort of default setting, whether it's the left or the right, well, basically, you know, these are businesses. They want to make money, and they make money by getting you angry and engaged. And then you punch back and somebody punches back at you. You know, you don't have to do it. It's not required. But the second thing is this just like the mainstream media where it's becoming more siloed? If you're liberal, you go on Threads. If you're conservative, you go on Twitter. If you want to look up your old high school girlfriends, you go on Facebook. I don't know, but it kind of seems that way. And why would social media be exempt from this trend? People like to hang out with other people who they think are like them and agree with them. Although those who disagree with you will find you one way or another. Well, it's nice to be able to end on something like that. Thanks for sticking with the podcast here. We'll see you tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
The Will Kane Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Kane as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.